Hello, everyone. This is Philosophy of the People with Ben Burgess and Stefan Bertram. Today we will be discussing whether, from a certain subject position, it might be kind of wrong or something you shouldn't do to condemn certain things. I wanted to start off today first having a whinge, because I've moved house and I've just managed to plug in my fancy expensive microphone bought by me by Doug Lane, and it does not work.
Damn it, Doug.
It has lasted a year, but it seems to have taken some kind of trouble during the move. I mean, the light comes on and everything, but when you plug it in, it's giving me device not recognized. Hopefully, I mean, it might just be a software issue, but it could also be a problem with the cable. But luckily, the cable is detachable, so maybe it's fixable. And then I wanted to make things worse by beginning this show where we talk about Israel by bringing up anti-Semitism. Because I've seen some very funny tweets from Nick Land recently, who is not an anti-Semite, as it turned out, and gets annoyed at his followers. He basically takes a, like, extreme anti-Semitism to be like a religion of its own, where kind of all troubles, metaphysical and otherwise, can be ascribed to the Jewish race. But coming from a completely different kind of discursive community to the one we're in, he clarifies at the end of these statements that actually he's fine with moderate anti-Semitism.
Sure, that sounds about right.
He's like, guys, come on. Like, the Jews aren't the source of all the world's problems.
Yeah, it's 25-30% max.
So, Ben, what's your essay about?
So the essay is called Look Who's Talking, G.A. Cohen on Israeli Condemnations of Palestinian Terrorism. And it is about a Cohen essay that I'd actually never run into until the last week, but I found interest in both because he sort of says interesting things about, about the sort of substance of the kind of immediate questions about the use of violence and more directly, sort of moral standing to condemn certain kinds of uses of violence that he's addressing in the paper, but also because, I'm a G.A. Cohen obsessive, and I mean, this sort of filled in an interesting part of his political biography for me, because I hadn't really seen much by him before on Israel-Palestine. There's a book that I read by him like a year or so ago, where he says some things in passing about it that weren't very clear to me, at least when I read it, what he meant. He kind of said something about often being disturbed by things that Israel does in the occupied territories, and he refers to himself as a non-Zionist, and the what exactly a non-Zionist is and how it's different from an anti-Zionist. I kind of had no idea when I was reading that passage. And in this, I mean, just to kind of start at the end of the Cohen essay, he actually does get in, at least a little bit of depth in about his sort of personal progression there, because there are some like references that are within the kind of main body of the essay itself, but it also comes with this appendix called, Israel and Me, that I found really interesting, both because of my general interest in Cohen and also because this is a sort of topic that I'll, write about for Jacobin. And, I've spent a long time, thinking about, if I were, if I were going to write a Israel and Me essay, I'd probably talk about arguing with my late grandmother about this subject many, many years ago. And so I always find this, I always find this kind of narrative, this this sort of disillusionment with Zionism narrative interesting.
Were you ever particularly illusioned, Ben?
I think at my worst, I was only very moderately illusioned.
Did you ever take the dumb free trip?
I never took the dumb tree free trip. My younger brother was actually signed up to take the dumb free trip, but that was like when he was like supposed to go was right when Operation Cast Lead happened, and he was like, okay, I'm not gonna go on like a propaganda tour while they're like bombing the fuck out of Gaza. That's too much, you know. So it's which is probably just as well that, you know, he didn't like go and get into like screaming arguments with the tour guides or whatever. So no free trip for me. I actually told him at the end of the conversation we had about that at the time, whenever that was, like 2014, that it's like, look, if you ever just want to go just normally, I'll go with you, but don't do this. This is going to be a very bad time under the circumstances. But there was a time I was moderately illusioned in a sort of what I would now consider to be moderately illusioned, which is to say that like my position was well to the left of any sort of establishment Jewish institutions, but it was a sort of Tikkun magazine kind of liberal two-state Zionism.
Which, you know, wouldn't be the end of the world if there was any possibility of it coming true in any substantive way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of say that in a footnote to this essay, that it's like, look, if sort of I'm increasingly pessimistic about this ever actually happening, but if the political practicalities worked themselves out so that there was some kind of negotiated two-state solution, that, you know, so in other words, Israel ended its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and allowed the Palestinians to, you know, be citizens of something, then that would be, you know, some measure of justice. That'd be a step in the right direction. I mean, ultimately, you know, if you could just will away the political practicalities, you know, my preference would be for what's called the one state solution, which is
socialist secular Levantine Republic.
Precisely. Yes. you know, which is yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it would be put in the jargon of a Trotskyist newspaper headline, but I also think it's substantially correct. And on a certain level of analysis, I mean, what's called the one state solution, which would just be, look, right now you have a tightly integrated geographical entity where, you know, the West, you know, I mean, Gaza is a little bit different. It's, you know, in effect, it's like a, not unlike an open air prison camp that's bombed sometimes, but, the West Bank certainly is a, you know, is fully integrated into the state of Israel in every way except one, right? Like if you are an Israeli citizen and you go to live on a settlement on the West Bank, for every legal purposes, you're considered to live within Israel. You know, I mean, all of the, you know, all of the systems that, you know, like your, that undergird your life are totally integrated, you know, with what exists in, you know, Israel proper, the internationally recognized borders. The only sense in which there isn't already one state is that the Palestinians who live on the West Bank aren't citizens. That they don't have they can't vote in Israeli elections. If they're accused of crimes, they're tried under military law rather than Israeli civilian law. So, you know, what's called the one state solution really just amounts to taking what's already one state and just giving everybody who lives there citizenship, which I would argue in practically any other circumstances. I mean, this isn't even a sort of radical socialist proposal. This is just a application of boringly standard liberal democratic principles to a situation everybody seems to regard as a zone of exception. to those principles for reasons I've just, you know, long not found particularly compelling, right? But to go back to Cohen, I mean, just to complete that part of the story, in his case, he was, when Israel was created, he was 7 years old, but like I've learned many people, he seems to have much more detailed memories of being seven than I seem to have. I mentioned a footnote while I was reading, at the same time I read this, I was reading something by Quentin Tarantino where he was talking about his parents taking him to the movies when he was seven, and he seems to remember everything about that experience. It's like, man, do I just have a really bad memory? I don't know. But anyway, Cohen is describing when he was seven, being taken by his parents to sort of mass celebration, the Montreal Jewish community of the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. And the thing that would, if you don't know all this history, that would strike many people as peculiar about this is that Cohen was raised in a Communist Party of Canada family. I think his mom was a party member. His dad was a fellow traveler, as were various uncles and aunts and et cetera. And you might think, well, hold on, how is it that they're Zionists and, ardent Zionists in 1948 go into this celebration and singing the Hatikva and all that? One of the crimes of Stalin that is, I think, widely forgotten, largely because so many anti-communists don't regard it as a crime, is that the USSR was a sort of crucial superpower backer of the State of Israel in 1948.
Yeah, it's funny. I was going to say both that, Stalin was clearly the evangelicals of the day, of like an anti-Semitic Zionist.
Yeah.
It is funny about Stalin that, someone that was probably almost certainly personally anti-Semitic never really did anything about it, which is especially strange when you're considering that he's Stalin.
Yeah.
He usually did lots of things about lots of things. I mean, there's obviously the doctor's plot, but compared to like average Stalinist stuff, that's like nothing.
Yeah. I mean, I know he sort of used it a little bit as a rhetorical tool against the opposition in the 1920s. Like, there's this classic quote from Stalin I always remember where he says, "We fight the oppositionists not because they're Jews, but because they're oppositionists," which is sort of cleverly implants the suggestion in the listener's mind that they are Jews. But yeah, you're right. I mean, for the most part, anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union was, as far as I know, right, wasn't really that bad during most of the Stalin era. I mean, it was kind of getting bad just before he died, but but yeah, no, that is definitely interesting. But
we should make clear that at the time it kind of did make sense, because all the Jews were communists, while all the Arab states were like British puppet monarchies, and that changed very quickly. But
it does. I mean, we are talking about the Soviet Union aiding a process of a war effort that involved an awful lot of ethnic cleansing, but you're right. In a geopolitical sense, it did make sense at the time that it happened. This is like early Cohen, and of course the Soviet Union obviously changes its stance on that. But kind of probably by the time that's really kicked in, he's sort of drifted outside of the Communist Party orbit to some extent anyway, or whatever. At any rate, as a teenager, he drifts outside of the Communist Party orbit, but he talks in particular about a trip to Israel he took to give a talk in 1983, and some of his experiences talking to Palestinian citizens of Israel, what would previously be referred to as Israeli Arabs, and kind of learning more both about, you know, both about the occupation and about the treatment of, you know, Palestinians within Israel. And, you know, he tells the story about going to this, this like memorial meeting for a murdered Israeli leftist. And who he says was the first case he knew of a Jew who was killed by another Jew because they disagreed about, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the second being Yitzhak Rabin. And at that memorial meeting, at the end, you know, it's still, this is still sort of left Zionist kind of people. They're singing the Israeli national anthem again, you know, the Hatikva. This time he's sort of very hesitant about it, but, you know, but he sings along, and he kind of says at the end of this brief reflection at the end of the paper that, the more he's kind of registered the, what he calls the semi-apartheid, semi-colonial status of Palestinians in the occupied territories, that, you know, he can't imagine singing along. Well, now being 2003, you know, when he's writing the paper.
But Ben, what is our philosophical issue of the day?
Yeah, all right. Well, so yeah, all of this is interest in political biography, but it has nothing to do with philosophy. So yeah, let's do the philosophy, because in a way it's a very simple
point. I'm very sus of the idea, but I'm willing to be convinced.
Yeah. Okay. So I think it has at least some plausibility. It's at the very least, like, one of the things I appreciate about him is, you know, is that even though I can think of other examples elsewhere in his work where I've, like, much more firmly disagreed with the point, this one I actually think has some plausibility to it, that, you know, this is a guy who, when he sort of has a moral instinct about something that, like, might seem, you know, to maybe contradict some of his other views or whatever, instead of just being like, eh, you know, he writes a paper and does like this kind of deep dive logic chopping exploration of whether or not it's actually inconsistent. And so in this case, he's talking, one last bit of biography. He has this nice thing at the beginning where he talks about various members of his family who are sort of near miss, almost fatalities in various kinds of political violence, you know, that is his son and soon to be daughter-in-law were almost killed by like a grenade that somebody threw in a cafe in Addis Ababa, and his daughter was I'm not quite sure for what purpose, was not far from the factory in Sudan that that Bill Clinton bombed in the end of the 90s. And that does kind of definitely kind of set the political tone for some of what he's saying, right? This is very much a product of this paper is very much a product of the specific political moment in 2003, which is the global war on terror, back when people unabashedly use that phrase, combined with the particular context he's interested in, which is the Second Intifada, which involved, to be fair, like really heinous things being done, you know, by, militant groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad.
Yeah, in the mid 2000s, like, I mean, basically that first decade of the 21st century, even PLFP, who haven't done these things and didn't do them before, were doing like stuff where they were like RPGing, like cars full of just settlers, but, you know, just like teens.
Yeah.
Who weren't like, you know, weren't holding weapons or anything.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's like, and the sort of worst end of the spectrum involves stuff that's much worse than that. You know, that's like,
right. At least they never did like knife attacks.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, you know, sending suicide bombers into like Sparrow's Pizza in Jerusalem. So the sort of thing that inspired this paper, right, Cohen, you know, been taught for decades at Oxford and, you know, living in the UK at this time, he's talking about listening to Israel's ambassador to Britain on the radio, using this phrase about how, well, nothing can justify this sort of thing, you know, whatever the Palestinians' grievances are. And I think a lot of what he's doing in the paper is he's trying to work out kind of why hearing the Israeli ambassador say that made him so angry.
Triggered him.
Was that?
Triggered him.
Yeah, exactly. Why he was so triggered by this, considering that, like, the sort of propositional content of the statement that nothing justifies this is not something he's necessarily interested in denying in this paper. That, you know, whatever kind of discussion you might have about whether, you know, some sort of utilitarian case for attacks that deliberately target civilians might actually make them justified under some circumstances or whatever, that's not a place Cohen's going in the paper. He's sort of bracketing that entire issue and saying, look, let's at least assume for the sake of argument that that he's right, right? That nothing does justify these kinds of tactics. So given that, am I, he wonders, right, still sort of within my rights to be triggered by the Israeli ambassador saying this, not as a sort of neutral observation, but like in the sort of stance of condemnation, that, you know, the sort of purpose of the Speech Act is to, you know, wag his finger, you know, at the Palestinians for doing these things. And Cohen found that outrageous, and he was basically trying to think through, okay, well, is there a defensible sense in which this is outrageous? Because you might wonder, like, okay, hold on. If it's true that nothing justifies it, it's true no matter who says it. And, you know, in fact, if you're sort of taking, you know, perhaps the hypocrisy of a representative of the Israeli government, you know, deploring violence against civilians
The normal problem with these kinds of statements is, like, yes, these, you know, this person points out, you know, despite these grievances, nothing can justify these terrible things. So we're going to do loads of terrible things which are more or less identical.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you were going to say, well, okay, it's hypocritical for a representative of the Israeli government to, you know, condemn this stuff, say it's unjustifiable, therefore he's wrong that it's unjustifiable, then that's, you know, committing a textbook logical fallacy, right? That's tu quoque. You know, it's the, you also, right, in Latin, you know, it's the appeal to hypocrisy fallacy. Like, you know, when, you know, I don't know, I like debated Stefan Molyneux, and he was trying to make great hay of the fact that, you know, my books had copyright pages on them and you had to pay for them. You know, it's like, oh, you know, here you are condemning capitalist markets and, you know, participating in them. That's, you know, above and beyond the fact that I don't particularly, you know, advocate the abolition of royalties. Certainly not without changing a lot of other things.
If he's offering you like a salaried position working for like the Department of Literature, then okay. But like otherwise, what do you say?
Exactly. Yeah, no, I could imagine a socialist society in which we had something like Department of Literature and we could like sort of reasonably abolish, you know, the artificial scarcity of intellectual property. But, you know, that would have to be a package deal. But in any case, even beyond that. Yeah, exactly. Even beyond that, there's a, you know, it's a bigger thing, which is like, look, it's just not a counter argument, right? I mean, like, let's say I'm the most like obscenely hypocritical champagne socialist of all time. Fine, you still have to tell me why I'm wrong, right? Like, you haven't actually responded to that yet. So this is the, you know, so I think on a quick reading, I mean, you might think, well, hold on. So aren't you just committing this fallacy? In fact, like, I guess I take it this was your point a minute ago. Like, hey, if, you know, you're saying you yourself do these things, you know, there's like, why is that relevant unless those things are objectionable? You know, there's like inconsistency to go around here, maybe. So the distinction that Cohen's going to make, and maybe just as a sort of question of moral intuition, you know, by this distinction, is between, again, like the propositional content of what he's saying, like just the assertion that it's unjustifiable, and the posture of condemnation, the speech act of, you know, of you know, saying, no, this is very bad. You know, you're, you know, like of judging it. And one of the, you know, points he makes, right? I mean, I would obviously be a completely, you know, it would take certainly a full paper of its own to sort of unpack that distinction. But he does suggest that, you know, if we all kind of understand what somebody means when they say something that of the form that we've probably all heard at some point, which is, look, I know I'm in no position to condemn this, but I think it's wrong, right? Then if we understand what that means, then that suggests that we do make some distinction between just sort of the content of the claim that something isn't justifiable, or this kind of posture of condemnation. And the posture of condemnation, you know, I think he's suggesting that it's like sort of it's like legitimately infuriating coming from a representative of the Israeli government, basically for three reasons. One is the straightforward point about hypocrisy. It's that, you know, Israel, you know, like even at the height of the Second Intifada, when all that stuff we were talking about was routinely going on, it was still the case that the Israeli military was killing way more Palestinian civilians than Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the PFP and everybody were killing, were killing Israeli civilians. So, you know, there is this whole, this is where, you know, he sort of says in the, you know, I don't know, he has some like earthy example about, you know, hearing his like relatives arguing growing up about, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you weren't at the bar, you know, Gershom, you weren't at the bar, everybody was expecting you, what happened? It's like, ah, look who's talking, you know, you missed, you know, twice last week, right? So that's the sort of straightforward look who's talking.
It's my second cousin's bar mitzvah.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so that's the look who's talking part. You know, it's the you know, pot calling the kettle black. There's a fun footnote, by the way. Didn't have a chance to say anything about this in the paper, but I enjoyed it, where he's quoting somebody, you know, he's quoting variations on this phrase, and he's quoting somebody who was talking about T.S. Eliot clearing some other writer of the accusation of fascist sympathies. And this guy says, coming from T.S. Eliot, that's the pot calling the kettle white. But in any case, might be a little bit unfair of T.S. Eliot, but it's very funny. So that's the first one. And then the second one is that that it's there's something sort of particularly grating about saying, oh, you're not justified in doing it, whatever legitimate grievances you might have, when you're speaking as a representative of the people who are causing the grievances. In the first place, that, you know, that you were
right. I mean, and this is the one I found most convincing. It's always, you know, whenever I think about, whenever like Hamas or whoever, Palestinian Jihad, do their like unguided rocket attacks out of Gaza, and yeah, then people complain that, you know, they're not targeting military bases; they're talking like targeting civilian infrastructure. I mean,
yeah, World War II era technology. They don't have targeted missile systems.
Yeah, exactly. So the solution is to give Hamas guided missiles, obviously, to that kind of complaint.
Yeah, well, this would actually, I think, be moving into the sort of third point, which, you know, so point A is hypocrisy. Point B is hey, you are the cause of the very grievances that you want to, you're trying to bracket out here as new relevance in this discussion. Point C, which is not unrelated in practice to B, is that when somebody has been left with no, like, again, this is all assuming for the sake of argument that these tactics are unjustifiable, but it's like, okay, but you're still condemning a resort to unjustifiable tactics by people you have deprived of any possible resort to more justifiable ones, right? You know, you're condemning the use of unconventional warfare by people who you've deprived of the capacity to engage in conventional warfare, or for that matter, Cohen points out, more straightforward ways of, you know, nonviolently settling political grievances, for example, through voting the government, inflicting the grievance out of office, right? I mean, neither, you know, you've deprived them of all these things because, you know, you haven't given them, you know, you haven't given them citizenship in Israel itself and thus the capacity to nonviolently use the political process to deal with any grievances they have with the Israeli government. You also haven't, you know, ended the occupation, let them form their own state in the West Bank and Gaza.
You bombed their only airport and you've blockaded their only port.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it's like, so no political process to use to address grievances, no like army of their own as they would have with an independent state, which they could like wage conventional warfare if, you know, if
yeah, there's no problem. And no option to kind of be an independent economic actor.
Yeah, exactly, right? So you know, and I think, you know, to me, I mean, I think these three are sort of most powerful as a package deal, right? You know, that we're condemning you for doing something that A, we are ourselves doing even more of, to you, and B, trying to say, yeah, whatever your grievances are, none of that matters when we are the, you know, we're not some, you know, speaking as some neutral bystander, we're the cause of the grievances, and C, you know, that we've deprived you of any alternate means of addressing those grievances. So even if you accept for the sake of argument that these are unjustifiable tactics, that it's like that, you know, that the Palestinians are in this like morally tragic state where the only tool left to them to resist the oppression is one that it wouldn't be justifiable to use. Even if you know, the second part doesn't necessarily follow for the first, but I mean, even if you think all of that, right, then it's still particularly grating to hear from the people who caused the situation, took away all the other tools for resisting oppression, and are also doing the same and more themselves, this kind of moral lecture on, you know, how dare you do all this? What could you possibly have been thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my problem with this is that if these kind of arguments hold for these people not condemning it, I don't really see why that shouldn't, you know, either it results into a general state of not condemning or, you know, no condemning at all. And it is true that the Israeli ambassador doing these things is more annoying than if I had done these things. But if the arguments follow that say, you know, Palestinian jihad are doing these actions because they have no other choice and thus, you know, what exactly are we condemning? My question is just kind of why does that apply to the Israeli ambassador not to me? But I guess the point is, you know, not to see these kind of speeches on the radio as something published in a philosophy journal, but something like which is a speech act, which might be able to, you know, be able to make things different in some sense.
Yeah, right. So speech act is just a general term for talking about kinds of things that we're doing with speech, right? So one kind of speech act is one where all we're trying to do is convey information, but oftentimes the purpose of a speech act is to express an attitude. For example, which is the sort of point in this case, that there's something about the attitude being expressed and therefore about the expression of it that's objectionable given this particular speaker. So as to why, because, you know, what you put your finger on is an important distinction, because Cohen is at pains to deny that sort of generalization, right? Like, he doesn't actually think that the fact that the Israeli ambassador lacks some sort of moral standing to condemn this means that nobody can condemn it. And he doesn't think that the fact that, if it is a fact, that other sorts of forms of redress have been taken away necessarily means there's nothing to condemn about resorting to this one. I mean, it's plausible that there might be situations in which the only way that you have a legitimate grief, I mean, abstracting from the Palestinian case, just thinking more general terms, there could well be situations where you have like a legitimate grievance and your only means of redressing it is so totally morally unacceptable that you actually have an obligation to just not address not do anything about your grievance. I mean, if, I don't know if somebody's, I think even thinking about like the trolley problem and stuff that, if the only, if you were poisoned, and
the analytic philosopher is trying to make an example.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I can do this. So you're poisoned and that's why you're having organ failure, right? This is the hospital case. So it's not just that you something tragic happens to have befallen you, right? You have this like entirely legitimate grievance that your enemy is poisoning you, and the poison's leading to organ failure, and the only way to the only way for you to sort of survive this attack is to kill your enemy's like completely innocent daughter in order to harvest some of her organs to, have your friend transplant them into you, and don't ask too many questions about why that's your only option. Just assume, did not have very much time to work this one up. So let's just assume that this is the, that somehow you're in a bizarre situation where this is the only option available to you. Then you might think, you might plausibly think, yeah, this is like, you have a legitimate complaint, you were poisoned, and something unjust has been done to you, and the only thing you can do about it would be so utterly morally unacceptable that you have a moral obligation to do nothing, that what you did is unjustifiable. But where Cohen's point would kick in is, even if we accept for the sake of argument that that's the case, a third party might have the standing to condemn you for what you did. They know the whole situation and they see you fit as a fiddle the next day and say, hold on, what did you do? Right. And they might have standing to condemn you, but the guy who poisoned you in the first place, somehow deprived you of all the other means of redressing the situation, presumably has zero standing to condemn you for it. Right. This would be Cohen's argument.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you have to make a certain kind of distinction, because to me it feels clear that, it's perfectly right for the guy that poisoned you to believe and, to express, if asked, that you doing that thing of killing the baby, child, girl, whatever, is wrong.
Yeah.
But maybe that's different from him going out and condemning you. Because I guess kind of if we think about, I don't know if this is the point that Cohen's making, but, kind of like pragmatic terms, I've never condemned Hamas, even though I think Hamas are bad and do bad things.
Yeah.
What exactly would be the point of me condemning Hamas? Who's, you know, who's listening and who's whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you, you know, if anybody really wants to, if anybody...
I'm sure you've condemned Hamas in like a Jacobin article where you have to say like,
I actually don't think I have, but I suppose I will. I mean, if anybody really wants me to, I mean, it's for all the good that it will do, I'm happy to.
Right, yeah, like if I was debating some right-wing person, they were like, will you say that Hamas is bad? I'd be like, yeah, sure, whatever, man.
No, I remember, it's like the thing that comes up every few years in American politics where some, some like black progressive figure turns out to have had some sort of connection to Louis Farrakhan, and everybody asks, it becomes this big thing that everybody has to disavow Louis Farrakhan, and it's like, a guy is a powerless crank, but if you really want me to, I suppose I'll disavow him for you. But
just keep that locked in the bottom of the stream like a ticker.
But yeah, I mean, I think that there is, yeah, I think that would be the distinction, though, between, I think probably most of the time we don't really make much of a distinction between saying that something is bad and condemning it. But I think that there is probably some difference between a condemnatory attitude, right, and, having... And feeling even that it's something sort of objectively deserved. I mean, look, not everything, the world is full of things that I would agree objectively merit moral anger that I don't personally feel a lot of moral anger about, like that's a...
right, just, because our emotions aren't at least entirely voluntary. They're quite non-voluntary.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's sort of, and it's also probably true that there are times that I have agreed that somebody has done something wrong, but, look, I've never engaged in a massacre of civilians, but, I have, but that doesn't mean I've never done anything wrong in my life. And, so there are probably times that I've thought that somebody's done something wrong and I've sort of not been able to work up much of a condemnatory attitude because of the reflection who am I to talk, right? I've probably done worse, and even in a sort of
context. Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't get too lit because I did participate in a military battle where the American Air Force killed like 1,600 civilians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, I think intuitively there does seem to be at least some distinction there. I should also say that one thing we haven't really talked about that is interesting in this article and connects with some of what we've, talked about previously is that he does pause when he's talking about the hypocrisy objection. He does pause to consider a sort of way that... a way that a kind of standard defense of Israel's killing of Palestinian civilians that's like just made in ordinary political context could be sort of made philosophically respectable by something called the doctrine of double effect, which roughly says that there's a difference between intending to do something, and there's a morally important difference, or at least a morally not completely unimportant difference, between the intended effect of your action and the foreseen but not intended effect, which I will say I don't think it's going to be enough. I don't think it's going to be enough to get the Israeli military off the hook for, the hypocrisy that
it's really the favorite excuse of all kind of sophisticated militaries.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, like, There's a class, I don't know, classic, whatever. It was early 2000s sometime. There was this high-profile email exchange between Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky, where, which is also really funny because it ends with Harris asking Chomsky if he can publish it, and Chomsky basically is saying, "That seems like a really weird idea to me. I don't know what's wrong with you, but sure, go for it." But in this exchange, this is Harris's way of arguing that both Israel and the United States are not as bad as, you know, capital T, the terrorists. Also, by the way, a really fun thing about the Cohen article is that there's this very brief point where he kind of declines to try to do conceptual analysis of what terrorism is. He says the concept is too disordered for there to be a good way to do that, which I take to be a very polite Oxfordy way of saying that this is kind of a bullshit term. It's it's this label we slap on the things that they do, you know. So we put them in this box that's sort of like ontologically evil and totally different from anything that we might do in response. And in fact,
they've really had to flip it around recently, because in the present war, it's the Russians, the evil ones, who have cruise missiles.
Yeah, no, that's true. I actually remember thinking in spring of last year that it was really something. Watching the American media discover that dropping cluster bombs on cities was a war crime. I really wish they'd had this epiphany in 2003. Of course, they've kind of had to de-have it since then, since we started supplying Ukraine with cluster munitions.
They're getting lit over white phosphorus too, and all the kind of, it was just literally a list of American crimes that were...
Yeah. And look, I do think, you know, I will say, because I know a lot of people who might read the essay or watch the stream will sort of hear Doctor Double Effect and roll their eyes and sort of sounds like silly sophistry to them. I do actually think that there is a somewhat plausible case to be made for it. So in the essay, I link to a classic article by Philippa Foote where she talks about it, which is actually where the sort of original trolley case comes from. And, you know, I actually do think that there's something there that there are, you know, like it sort of sounds like silly sophistry when you first hear it. It's like, oh, what? Like, you know, intended versus foreseen. Come on, man.
I think it's a real thing. It just doesn't work for militaries where, like, you know, the results of kind of are so consistent and knowable in the future.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that they, you know, like the point, the sort of reasonable point that Cohen makes about this is, even though I think the Doctor Double Effect is more plausible than a lot of people hearing about it for the first time think it probably is, I would recommend people read that Philippa Foote paper. Once you really sort of spend some time thinking about the examples, it does start to sound a lot more plausible. But Cohen's point is it's just not going to be enough to do what defenders of the Israeli or American militaries want it to do. It's just not going to bear that kind of moral weight because, you know, it's a comparative principle. It says, like, all else being equal, it's worse to... I could never foresee a bill coming to be on. Yeah. This is a lot of what that Philippa Foote paper is sort of saying, look, they're not completely ridiculous. They're not saying that, you know, they're not saying that, well, my action, you know, my intention was to have the bullet fly through the air in front of me. And I did foresee that it would kill that guy. You know, that's like,
it was a warning shot and I have terrible accuracy.
But like it's just not going to be enough because the principle doesn't say, well, as long as it wasn't your sort of direct intention, go nuts, kill all the innocent people you want to. The principle says all else being equal, it's even worse to intentionally, you know, intentionally bring about the, you know, like to sort of, you know, to have your intention be to bring about the outcome, like killing civilians, for example, than to have your intention be something else, but like knowing that this is going to be a byproduct of it. But that's not, but like that could be true, but it doesn't follow from that, that like, oh, you know, if you kill five people by planting a bomb in a trash can and I kill, you know, 5,000 people by, you know, bombing the shit out of crowded urban areas, with the intention of killing a few terrorist leaders who live there, that like what you did is worse than what I did. I mean, that's just not enough to get you that result. Like yeah. it's still very bad. And if you're doing enough of it, it can still be worse.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be something for another time because we're about to stop, but I still also think that, you know, almost like, you know, soldiers are also people too.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's also true,
It might be bad to kill 5,000 of them, too.
It would be. And you know, and this is honestly, I mean, I think there are sort of plausible reasons why it's worse to kill civilians who are, after all, not shooting at you, etc. But I've thought about that a lot in the last year and a half, you know, with the war in Ukraine too, that it's like, that, you know, I do wish, like, look, if, especially a conscript, I mean, that's a, you know, I mean, that's like the way that like we can have these discussions sometimes where we sort of treat that as like, yeah, soldier, nothing to see here. Right. You know, no, you know, we should have no qualms whatsoever about like extending a war that could have ended, you know, a year ago, another year, because, you know, because it doesn't, you know, as long as we're just talking about soldiers, it doesn't matter how many of them die. It's like, well, I mean, especially like, I mean, I, you know, it's like that's sort of maybe most plausible with, you know, with somebody who volunteered for this particular war because they were so hyped up about it. And it gets a lot, you know. I mean, I don't think that person's life is nothing. I think that like buying into some propaganda doesn't actually mean that your life has zero value. But like, but especially when you get to people who had zero choice in the matter, that's a particularly, there's something that's like particularly disturbing about just acting as if it's like, oh yeah, whatever, you know, that's, they're, you know, they don't even go on the scales that we're balancing to decide what's justifiable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's something interesting to talk about, especially now, because we're in a state of the war where kind of all the fighting's happening in these open fields in Zaporizhia, where there's basically no civilians and no civilians are dying. But you have both sides are increasingly full of conscripts who are less and less interested in being there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, quite a while ago, actually, several months ago, I think there was an article in The Economist about like the sort of lengths to which, you know, because I mean, one thing that people, I mean, just a sort of very basic fact of the situation, sort of easy to forget, is that one advantage the Russians do have is that they just have a much bigger population. And so if there is some sort of gruesome long-term war of attrition that does benefit them. But in, you know, in the, you know, there's this Economist article several months ago about the sort of lengths to which, you know, like Ukrainian draft boards have started going, which is, it's like not, you know, if people are sort of imagining when they hear the draft, what they think of is something like the US during the Vietnam War, where, you know, you'd like, get a letter in the mail and, you know, you have to like show up to, you know, to the
office. And you go out with your hippie buddies and burn it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, there are people like literally being scooped up from like shopping malls and, you know, funerals, in some cases. Cause it's like, this is like a really, intense, like, you know, it's an unusually desperate situation. I mean, this is like a very 19th century style draft.
Yeah, but they also have lots of restrictive rules on like who can be drafted. Like Ukraine is still not drafting under-25s.
Okay.
Because they still want to keep their like education sector functional so that they can then export these people to Europe so they can earn money, etc. blah blah blah.
Right. Yeah, well, in any case, this is a depressing topic for next week. I don't know, maybe I'll finally do that Gnosticism thing. You know what I'm gonna say? James Lindsay's right. I'm a Gnostic.
Great. Soldiers' Lives Matter. Bye, everyone.